ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Peter Martin, host of The Economy Stupid, where we find economics in relationships.
She only wants a man if he's really, really good.
In the Reserve Bank board.
I knew. Everybody on the board knew recession was coming.
And in food.
It's about the cup of diesels required through the life cycle to get that chicken patty on your burger.
The Economy Stupid. Search for The Economy Stupid on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Massive explosion in Bali.
We are very concerned that Australians will be amongst those casualties.
Earthquakes have created massive tidal waves across Southeast Asia.
Killed in Indonesia's Aceh province after an initial quake off the island of...
Australian officials are already overstretched.
For the first time ever, Indonesia is entering a security agreement with another country.
Ratifying a major security treaty with Indonesia.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met with the Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto to finalise the agreement.
Our biggest near neighbour is changing before our very eyes. By the middle of this century, Indonesia is forecast to be the world's fourth largest economy. Imagine that.
Before, we just handwriting. Now we change to the high tech.
A lot of interesting things happens in Indonesia, right? It's a fast growth for economic, especially in the trade.
Hamish has been in Indonesia, gathering a treasure trove of interviews for Global Roaming.
Geraldine, how lucky are we to have this big neighbour, which is, for the most part, democratic, peaceful, growing, which does seem to want to be our friend, but which is interesting and fascinating and dynamic. That, for me, is the thing, the allure of the Indonesia story.
It's getting better. We move forward about the economic changes.
The youth is ready. We are ready.
We're changing a lot about the economic and the government.
Very eager to have globalization.
Today, the next installment of our Indonesia Rising miniseries. We're unravelling some of the mysteries of a nation right on our doorstep about which we know so little.
It's Hamish here in Jakarta.
I'm Geraldine Doogue and this is Indonesia Rising from Global Roaming. Yes, you know, I've been so enjoying this series, Hamish, but I saw this fascinating observation in one of my bits of reading about Prabowo possibly doing an Iran with the Straits of Hormuz, sort of floating the notion that the Malacca Straits might be something they could actually put a toll on. People, obviously, the region said, what?
I can imagine the Malaysians might have had a reaction, yes, as just with the Singaporeans.
And it was, you know, dismissed as, just a little joke. But really, and of course, there are other two straits, the Sunda Straits and the Makassar Strait.
So up towards the Spice Islands.
Yes. And when you look more deeply into it, I think it's Prabowo himself who said 70% of East Asia's energy needs and 70% of their trade passes through Indonesian seas, he said. Just a little note. So, like, what's going on there?
I'm really glad you mentioned this because I think it's such a profound reminder of why Indonesia as a trading route, as a trading port, was of such interest, particularly, you know, pre-World War II, why it was so heavily fought over, why the Japanese were interested in it, why the Dutch were there for so long. And I think, in a way, it's a really good setting for us to have the conversation that we're going to have today, because David Van Reybrouck is essentially asking us, inviting us, to reconsider what we know and understand about Indonesia's pathway to independence. It is such an extraordinary story, but I've got to say, having read the book and put this episode together, it's really made me ask a lot of questions.
Mm. And are the Indonesians themselves, I mean, you've just been there, are they at all interested and curious about this post-colonial period, which I think David Van Reybrouck sort of, it's riveting. You don't hear much of that coming out of Indonesia.
Look, not in the way that he necessarily describes it. His argument essentially is, look, the Indonesian independence story is told as national history in Indonesia and in the Netherlands because it was the sort of the separation from the colonial power. But we don't interpret it or understand it as important global history. And he's asking us to consider that moment, that period, as a global moment. So I don't know that necessarily Indonesians are talking about it in that way. But as you'll hear in this conversation, he was surprised at how much interest there has been in Indonesia when he went to launch the Indonesian language version of the book. There's definitely something going on in Indonesia, sort of redefining of Indonesia's place in the world. And I think we should also mention that Prabowo's government has tried to rewrite the formal national history since coming to power. That's been hugely controversial.
Right.
They've tried to erase some of the darker chapters, you know, the sort of 1960s, the war on the communists, the disappearances towards the end of the New Order regime, some of which Prabowo is alleged to have been involved in, the nomination of Suharto as a national hero. That's been very controversial as well. So this Prabowo government is, I guess, redefining or revising history, but not in the way necessarily that Van Rabel is advocating.
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting. I don't honestly like the sound of that idea, but because I just think you've got countries that don't face their history full on, I think they pay a price for it. But
yeah.
I mean, it was the first country after the World War II to declare independence after the war. And you know, I don't, honestly don't think many Australians got a first clue about that.
Yeah, I know you hate refreshers and lists, but I do think a couple of kind of key dates are worth laying out for listeners before we dive into the conversation with this remarkable historian. So Japan invades the Dutch East Indies in 1942. After the Japanese surrender, Sukarno, the nationalist leader, is effectively forced by some of the student leaders to declare independence. And he sort of does it out of nowhere.
Just nowhere else comes in. Nobody comes in. Like it's sort of open, isn't it?
Well, the Dutch had left, had been forced out, and then the Japanese surrendered. So they were kind of left not quite knowing what to do with it. And he just reads this little declaration of independence. And then this begins 4 years of guerrilla warfare. The Dutch obviously still want to hold on to it. And then this leads to many decades and chapters of complicated and violent uprisings, whether you're talking about the Maluku's or West Papua. Then there's the whole question of East Timor, which was Portuguese. And then the Indonesians take that and we all know what happens from there. The Sukarno era leads then to the Suharto era, which is known as the New Order regime. You'll hear that referred to. So just a couple of little marker points there for you. Mm. David Van Reybroek is a Belgian historian. He's written this book called Revolusie, based on nearly 6 years of hundreds of interviews with some of the last living eyewitnesses of this independence struggle, some of them Japanese, some of them Javanese, some of them Indonesian, but living in the Netherlands. It's just the most magnificent picture of an important moment of history. Here's David Van Reybroek. David Van Reybroek, welcome to Global Roaming.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for talking to us. I've got to say congratulations on the book. I absolutely devoured it. But I've got to say we're near neighbours of Indonesia, and I don't think we really recognise the independence story as a much bigger global historical moment in the way that you are inviting us to consider. So I've got to say this really challenged some of my understanding.
Amish, you're not the only ones, and Australia is not the only one. There is this funny tendency to believe that if revolutions take place in the Northern Hemisphere, they are world history. If they take place in the Southern Hemisphere, they are at best regional history. So the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution are seen as very important for the world at large, but it has taken decades before we realize the importance of the Haitian Revolution of 1804. This was actually as important as the French Revolution. And I think the Indonesian Revolution of 1945-46 was as important as a world event, as a global event, unleashing the entire decolonization movement in Africa, in the Arab world, spurring anti-imperialism in Latin America. I mean, it was a real event with major global consequences. But until quite recently, it was only experienced as national history in two countries, in Indonesia and in the Netherlands. For the Netherlands, it was the loss of their overseas empire. For Indonesia, it was the beginning of their independence. It's understandable that this is the main focus, but it is only now that we see that it had really implications well beyond these two countries.
Can you expand on that? What did the Indonesian Revolution and the intellectual basis for it, what did that give birth to globally?
Well, first of all, Indonesia was the first country to proclaim independence after World War II.
Batavia has been the center of the Indonesian nationalist movement, and a pretty thorough and up-to-date organization it seems to be. The leader of the movement, which, as I've said, is centered in Java, is Dr. Sukarno. He's seen here presiding over a meeting of what he calls the cabinet of the Indonesian Republic's government.
Only 2 days after the Japanese capitulation, the Indonesians proclaimed their independence. Sukarno and Hatta, spurred by a generation of young Indonesians, proclaimed the independence. So they were the first. And the template of how do you turn a colony into a country, that template was not written, was not clear. And the Indonesian experience became the recipe. Like you have to, it has to go fast. It has to involve the entire territory of the former colony, and it has to involve all the political powers.
As long ago as December 1942, the Queen of Holland promised a large degree of self-government to Dutch overseas possessions. Dr. Sukarno, however, demands complete independence for about 70 million people now.
That was not a given. European powers, they started thinking about a slow decolonization with the partial transfers of powers on a partial territory taking decades. And so the Indonesian experience was really, they called it Merdeka 100%, so freedom 100%. And it was the idea that it has to be fast, it has to be complete, and it has to encompass the total territory of the former colony. That template has been used over and over later in, when you look at what is happening in Africa in 1960, the year in which 18 countries got their independence, they all followed the Indonesian recipe. There's no coincidence that African countries took inspiration from the Indonesian template, because 10 years after the proclamasi in 45, Sukarno organized the Bandung Conference in 1955. And the idea was the five countries that have recently gotten independent from the British and the Dutch will organize a conference to inspire other colonies to become independent the way we have done it ourselves. And this was really Sukarno's view. Originally, it was going to be a modest conference with five countries. And Sukarno said, no. We have to invite dozens and dozens of colonies aspiring to be free.
Yeah, I think if anything, for me, the thing that did most tilt my thinking and understanding about this story is that where we often think about and see the Indonesian pathway to independence as almost reluctant, like slightly confused, slightly contested, different factions, nationalists, communists, etc., that kind of inched their way there eventually. You paint a picture of something that was actually much more ambitious and much more global in its foresight, and maybe we can talk about that. But you do also reference in the book that this cohort looked to India, looked to Gandhi. So it's not like this concept of, you know, post-colonialism was born out of Indonesia. What are you saying was different about the Indonesian approach compared with, say, India? Why is this the global story?
That's really interesting. When I was doing my fieldwork in Indonesia, I went there to interview close to 200 witnesses who are still alive. I met this one lady, Herawati Dia, in Jakarta. She was 99 years old, and she had been incredible, with the first Indonesian woman with an American college degree. Her husband was a journalist. She started a magazine for Indonesian women. And during the long struggle for independence, she traveled to India, and she got to meet Mahatma Gandhi a few months before he was killed. And it was when I was listening to her that I really understood colonies were not just fighting against their colonial overlords above them. they were taking so much inspiration from each other, from events in the Arab world, events in the Indian world. And Mahatma Gandhi was such a source of inspiration for people like Sultan Shahrir, who would become the first prime minister of the independent Indonesia. And so there's much more than just this vertical dynamic. There's also this horizontal dynamic. It's not just countries in the south looking up to the north and trying to liberate themselves. There is this horizontal south-south dynamic, which is hardly ever seen. And so the Indian experience was really, really important for an entire generation of Indonesian freedom fighters.
You're listening to our chat with David van Reybroek. He's the author of Revolusi.
I think the other thing which you spell out very clearly is the imagination that was involved for this cohort of independence leaders. And it was not a homogenous grouping as it rarely ever is. The young and the old, a generational divide, people with different ideologies floating around, you know, cohorts of them that have been studying in Leiden, in the Netherlands, a lot of intellectual work done there, particularly in the lead up to World War II. But I think what you do is explain in a way that I haven't really seen before the idea that there was nothing certain about Indonesia as a concept, right? Because it had only been actually a Dutch colony for less than the overall Dutch time. Initially, it was the Dutch traders, the East Indies Company. Then it eventually became a Dutch colony. And then World War II happens and it kind of shifts everything on its head and there's this kind of, the moment presents itself. It could have ended up in so many different scenarios. Why do you think it ended up as this huge edifice of a country just to our north? And I guess I'm asking that because I'm hoping you can help our listeners understand what it is that we contend with today.
That's a big question, but afterwards, we often have the tendency to believe that what happened had to happen, that it was a natural phenomenon that was unstoppable. But it could have gone many, many different ways. Already, the Indonesian thirst for independence was diverse. In the 1910s, it took the form of political Islam. In the 1920s, Marxism became more important. In the 1930s, it was more Indonesian nationalism. And Sukarno then tried to bring these three distinct blood groups together, distinct but with a lot of overlap. A lot of Marxists did not believe that religion was opium for the people. They were devout Muslims who were Marxists at the same time and who could be nationalists as well. So Sukarno tried to bring this together into one big political movement, which was severely repressed by the Dutch colonial authorities. If you would have had the chance to travel through Indonesia in the late 1930s, you would have a hard time believing that this region, this colony, was going to be a free, independent country in a couple of years' time and becoming the fourth most populous country in the world. It was fragmented. The Dutch colonial authorities did everything to keep things apart. There was a bit of a beginning of a national language, but it was only in the late 1920s that activists started to campaign for Bahasa Indonesia as the national language. I mean, the archipelago is the biggest in the world. It's 1/8 of the equator is Indonesia. If you project Indonesia on the map of Europe, in the west, it starts in Ireland and it ends in the east in Kazakhstan. This is what we're talking about. This was not experienced as a country. This was an archipelago with so many different languages, so many different cultural identities. It's nothing short of a miracle that a national identity and a national state was created out of this diversity. And this happened through violence. The Revolusi was a violent revolution, just like the Russian Revolution was violent and the French Revolution was violent. It was also crafted through a very conscious campaign of deliberate nation building. if you look at school books, textbooks that are being used in history classes in Indonesia, it's all about how we as a country came together and freed ourselves from the Dutch. I mean, there's this whole narrative keeping the country together. And in a sense, the West and the East, Ireland and Kazakhstan, are trying to break away. The Papuas are not always very happy with the way they have been treated by Java, and there's been a longing for more autonomy, even independence. And in the very west of the archipelago, you see that the tip of Sumatra has been longing for political freedom as well, the Aceh region, notably. And so today, this national narrative is still stretched out because it's seen as the national glue.
Mm. Do you think that precariousness, that tension, has become Indonesia's strength, or does it always hold it back? Like, if I'm thinking about the Indonesia of today and even our way of interacting with it, sometimes it's almost hard to know what you're looking at and what you're dealing with because it is so many things, because it has to be. But that can hold a nation back. Is it an ally of China? Is it led by a president that's fascinated with America, that wants a strong military relationship with Trump and wants to be on the board of peace with Trump? Is it a nation of Islam? This is this kind of like conundrum of Indonesia that I think Australians kind of grapple with all the time.
Yeah, I understand. And in the 1940s and in the 1950s, the world was looking at Indonesia as this was the place where events were unfolding. The first meetings of the United Nations Security Council were about Indonesia. I mean, it was really center stage of global affairs. And one can say that with the arrival of Suharto in 1965, when military power, a military dictatorship began, it became a very quiet giant.
Suharto rose to authority in the early 60s during the decline of President Sukarno. Having obliterated the opposition, his new order tried to captivate the West with a simple catch cry: development before politics. Foreign investment poured in, but with development came corruption, cronyism, and the emergence of a new business elite. To contain opposition, he reduced the number of political parties to three, ensuring the dominant Golkar party would always support his regime.
I think a few years ago, I saw a picture of dead President Jokovi standing next to Zelensky, the Ukrainian head of state. And I said, like, this is one of the very few times that you see Indonesia like taking a stance. Like, it's been invisible, an economic powerhouse, mostly working on economic diplomacy in a very quiet way. And that was like more of a geopolitical stance. Now, with the new president, Prabowo, things are changing. He seems to be looking for a more visible place on the global stage. We all remember the images from Davos when Donald Trump launched his peace board. Indeed, the Indonesian head of state was sitting on the stage in Davos. That is a fairly new development, and it might indicate that Indonesia is ready to become a slightly more visible giant. There's also perhaps some affinity between the autocratizing tendencies of Trump and the autocratizing tendencies of Prabowo. Indonesian people are protesting loud and clear, and especially young people, against loss of the democratic space for which the people has been fighting for such a long time. And that sort of flirtations with the new style autocrats is indicative. It seems as if in this new world order, Prabowo finds himself quite comfortable.
Yes, well, Hamish, honestly, that man and his book deserve all the accolades that they have been receiving. It has really been sort of enormously praised, hasn't it?
There's so much in this book, you know, even little details, right? That during the Second World War, the Dutch Queen was exiled in London, but there was discussion about her moving to Batavia and ruling the Dutch Empire, as it were, from Indonesia. There's also this fascinating detail that emerges in the book, which is that obviously Sukarno was kind of working with the Japanese fascists in Indonesia to throw off the Dutch colonialists. But there were a lot of Indonesian students in the Netherlands at the time when the Netherlands became occupied by the German fascists. And actually, per capita, the single largest grouping in the Netherlands that fought in the Dutch resistance against the Nazis were Indonesians.
Is that right?
It's just phenomenal detail. So I just got a lot out of it. I went to Bandung while I was in Indonesia. Of course, David talks about the Bandung summit that happened shortly after independence and the impact that's happened
54,
on...
55, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the way this shaped, in a sense, the global south that we talk about now. There's actually an amazing Bandung summit, Bandung conference museum there in Bandung with these little, you know, life-size models of Sukarno and the other leaders that are there. It's kind of dinky. It's in this beautiful little old Art Deco building. But I found myself so immersed in the story, having read this book before traveling there. I just can't recommend Revolusie strongly enough.
No, I mean, I must say, I think I really will try to pick it up. By the way, I don't think he talked about the role of the Australian wharfies. Did he talk about that? Who actually, I thought, played quite a significant role stopping goods travelling to the Dutch.
Yeah, and there is actually a little documentary on that, which we can put in the show notes if you want to understand a little bit more about the role of the Maritime Workers Union at that time. It's not something I discussed with David, but actually a few Indonesians pointed me to it while I was there. So that'll be in the show notes as well.
Okay, well, look, we've had some lovely feedback. This is from Jack in Hobart. I've been teaching Bahasa to school children for over 10 years in Hobart. At times it's so much fun, but it is no easy gig. I spend vast amounts of time and energy simply trying to justify my existence and the rationale behind learning Bahasa, oftentimes resorting to the mind-blowing stats, numbers and predictions. I find it astounding, he says, that within Australian media there is simply so little discussion and analysis of Indonesia and the Australia-Indonesia dialogue.
Yeah, I want to say thanks to Jack, because it was a much longer email with a lot of really thoughtful suggestions and ideas. We do appreciate it. Michael's emailed in asking, with all this talk of Indonesia, changes, alliances, neighbours, there is scant attention, if any, to what Indonesia is doing so ruthlessly in West Papua. Is it East Timor again? Is it taboo to discuss this? Well, it's certainly not taboo here. There's less discussion, I might add, of it in Indonesia. And there has actually been quite a bit of violence there in recent weeks, Geraldine.
Actually, one of the things about that Van Reybrouck work is the amount of violence that accompanied. My goodness, you have to stand back a bit from it, you know, post-war, pre-war, the Dutch do not come out of it well, but, violence as the broker of independence, my goodness.
And I think that's what people certainly say to you now in Indonesia when you talk about West Papua. They say, look at how much has changed. When you think about all the different provinces that wanted independence or wanted separation, whether you're talking about the Maluku's or Aceh, there was obviously the East Timor issue for a very long time. I think most people there would consider it quite remarkable that today there are far fewer of those violent problems.
And look, lastly, specifically on your guest Murray Pangestu, Richard emailed to say, Murray is, of course, a towering authority on Indonesian development and an honorary Canberran, as she said, and her word carries weight. Our political, business and academic leaders need to listen.
Well, thank you very much. Continue the feedback, please. global.roaming@abc.net.au. We're really loving the conversation that you're having with us about Indonesia and our relationship with our neighbours, so please do keep it coming. Thanks to our producers, Shane Anderson and Jesse Kate, Kylie Morris, and I will be back tomorrow. We're taking you to Poland.
Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.